Was the election last July of a constituent assembly in Venezuela illegitimate and unconstitutional? Who is behind the protests in opposition to the Maduro government? Why did the government of Hugo Chavez fail to address corruption, social violence, and other factors when it took power in the early 2000s? How critical a factor have U.S. agencies and foreign policy played in jeopardizing Venezuela's political and economic prospects? Why is the Canadian government leveling sanctions against the Maduro government, and what tangible impacts are they likely to have? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we revisit Venezuela on the eve of state elections and at a volatile moment in the history of the Bolivarian Revolution. Over the course of the next 60 minutes, we will hear from Caracas-based journalist Lucas Kerner on recent developments. We'll hear background from Professor of Comparative Politics and Venezuela expert Julia Buxton. And we'll get some thoughts about Canada's recent sanctioning of the South American state from University of Manitoba professor and solidarity activist Henry Heller. On this week's program, Venezuela and the Crosshairs. Are we witnessing a slow-motion coup d'etat? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 13th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In one of its recent initiatives, the Justice Department, or DOJ, appears to be attacking the First Amendment as part of the apparent bipartisan program to make Vladimir Putin the fall guy for everything that goes wrong in Washington. In the past month, the DOJ has revealed that the FBI is investigating Russian-owned news outlets, Sputnik News and RT International, and has sent letters to the latter demanding that one of its business affiliates register as a foreign agent by October 17th. The apparent line of inquiry that the Bureau is pursuing is that both are agencies of the Russian government and that both have been spreading disinformation that is intended to discredit the United States government and its institutions. This alleged action would make them, in the DOJ view, a propaganda arm of a foreign government rather than a news service. It also makes them subject to Department of the Treasury oversight under the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938. That comes from the article, Sputnik and Russia Today, Under Investigation by U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, by Philip Giraldi, posted October 11th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. The United States military has dropped a total of 751 bombs on Afghanistan in September, the highest monthly number in the past 7 years, according to data by the U.S. Air Force's Central Command. The figure indicated a 50% increase from August, 503 bombs, which the command attributed to President Donald Trump's so-called strategy to more proactively target extremist groups in the country. Since 2010, the highest number of bombs dropped on Afghanistan by the U.S. military was 589 in August 2012, still over 150 less than September 2017. The U.S. has dropped a total 3,238 bombs in Afghanistan between January and September this year, more than two times the 1,337 dropped the year before. This increase can be attributed to the president's strategy to more proactively target extremist groups that threaten the stability and security of the Afghan people, the report said. That comes from the article, U.S. military dropped 751 bombs in Afghanistan in September, posted October 10th, originally appearing at Press TV. Officials with the Federation Council Commission for the Protection of State Sovereignty concluded during a meeting on Monday that attempts to interfere in Russia's internal affairs were noticeable during the regional elections in September of this year, even though they did not show much influence on the outcome of the elections. It is worthy of note that the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe came to conclusion that Russia improperly executes the verdict of the European Court of Human Rights on the case of embezzlement at Kirovly's company. The committee left the case under control, and Russian senators found the decision of European officials, quote, an attempt on the Russian electoral sovereignty, unquote. According to the Council of the Federation, departments of the Council of Europe may make biased political decisions. Thus, the ECHR and other structures of the Council of Europe are dominated by representatives of the countries that imposed sanctions against Russia. That comes from the article, The Kremlin's U.S. Gate Probe. Russia gets ready for U.S. interference in 2018 presidential election, by Anton Kulikov, posted October 11th, originally appearing at Pravda Report. Former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff warned Sunday that Washington's interference in Venezuela is, quote-unquote, extremely dangerous and could provoke an armed conflict. Quote, our continent has been living in peace for 140 years. Any attempt to interfere in the legitimate constitutional process in Venezuela, including by forcing a presidential election, is extremely dangerous, as it might lead to a civil war, unquote, she said in an exclusive interview with RT in Moscow. Rousseff was herself impeached and removed from her elected post last year in what was widely decried as a parliamentary coup. The Brazilian leader likewise took aim at her Congress-designated successor, Michel Temer, who has moved to align Brasilia's foreign policy closely with Washington, leading the regional charge against the government in Caracas. That comes from the article, Ousted Brazilian President, U.S. Intervention in Venezuela Could Spark Civil War, by Lucas Kerner, posted October 10th, originally appearing at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. An aggressive Turkish move could now try to cut off the Kurdish Afrin area from the Syrian government-held areas by connecting the Turkish-controlled rebel area in the north with the Al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib governorate. Such a move would encounter fierce resistance not only from Kurdish elements and the Syrian government, but also from Iran. Auxiliary Iranian troops hold the government corridor between Aleppo and Afrin to protect some important Shia villages in the area. On one side, one can understand the Turkish abrogation of its duties under the Astana Agreement. Erdogan is afraid of the domestic backlash a real fight against HTS would likely cause. That comes from the article, Syria. Turkey violates Astana Agreement, renews alliance with Al-Qaeda. Posted October 10th, originally appearing at Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Maduro government has been facing a crisis of legitimacy, at least in the eyes of the international press. Last July, the government held an election for a constituent assembly which would be empowered to rewrite the constitution in nine critical areas. Critics within the U.S., Canada, and other allied powers have attempted to portray this action as an anti-democratic power grab by President Maduro. Meanwhile, over 120 people in Venezuela have died since April in connection with opposition protests and reprisals by Venezuelan security forces. And as this broadcast goes to air, Venezuela is in the run-up to regional elections, which will choose state governors with four-year mandates. To assess whether depictions of Maduro as a dictator have merit and what is behind the protests gaining world attention in recent months, we're joined by Lucas Kerner. He's a Caracas-based writer who has been following on-the-ground activities in Venezuela and contributes to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles frequently appear at globalresearch.ca. So, Lucas, how's it going?
Great to be here, Michael.
Well, thanks for joining us. Now, could we try to provide some context for the Constituent Assembly that was voted in a couple of months ago? It's being portrayed as anti-democratic. But what do you have to say share with our listeners about this? The constitutionality and legitimacy of the this Constitutional Assembly.
Yeah, I want to begin with the context in May in which it was called, in which basically you had, you know, in 2 months at that time of what, you know, have been depicted throughout the international media as peaceful, nonviolent protests against an authoritarian regime, but in reality for the mass majority of the population living here was, in fact, a violent right-wing insurgency that was bent on overthrowing the government, you know, demanding early presidential elections, even though presidential elections are not scheduled until 2018, and was, you know, using, you know, extremely violent tactics such as, you know, burning barricades in the middle of streets and actually shooting at people who attempted to remove them or causing traffic accidents or, you know, actually just political assassinations in a number of cases. And this was, you know, the context in which, you know, on May 1st, President Maduro invoked Venezuela's constitution, which has a provision to convoke a constituent assembly to redraft the constitution. And basically, you know, this was his bid to find a solution to the existing political impasse that's, you know, been, you know, Venezuela has been in the midst and the grips of an economic and increasingly political crisis for the last 3 years. And this was a bid to basically, you know, refound the country to, you know, rewrite the social contract, ensure a new foundation of legitimacy, you know, to go forward. And, you know, in that sense, also to defeat this right-wing insurgency that was seeking to overthrow the government. So in this sense, you know, Venezuela's constitution, unlike, you know, the United States constitution, for example, which, you know, one could argue is absolutely legitimate because it was never, you know, approved through any popular vote or any, it was actually, you know, approved by a group of, you know, merchants and slave owners, you know, after the Articles of Confederation was, you know, it dissolved, arguably, you know, illegally. That Venezuela's constitution was actually approved in 1999 by, you know, a popular referendum. So it has more legitimacy than most constitutions in the world. And in that constitution, unlike the United States and most, you know, countries of the global north, their constitutions, it has a provision that citizens can convoke an assembly to redraft a constitution. It actually provides provisions for its own, you know, dissolution and redrafting. And that's, you know, an incredibly progressive measure because, you know, if we had the United States, we could actually push for, you know, extremely significant progressive reforms that are barred by the framework of that constitution. So Maduro called this on May 1st, and throughout the country, there were, you know, anyone could basically collect a certain number of signatures to sign up. The opposition seeking to overthrow the government boycotted this process, as did the largest business federation of Chamber of Commerce, FedeCommerce. And basically, you know, you had 16,000 candidates. And because the opposition boycotted it, you had an interesting situation in which this July 30th election pitted, you know, the candidates who were backed by the PSU, by the ruling Socialist Party, by the bureaucracy, by the government, but you also had a lot of grassroots social movement candidates who were running against them. So you had this extremely, I would say, you know, rich dialectical interplay between these, you know, different proposals and the space and, you know, for, you know, internal, you know, contestation and critique that you would not have had otherwise. And this, you know, this itself explains the 8 million people, over 8.2 million people who came out to vote on July 30th, despite, you know, and amid this, you know, what can only really be described as a campaign of terror on the part of the opposition in which they attacked, you know, they besieged 200 voting centers throughout the country. You know, a candidate, you know, in Bolivar State to the Ibadi was assassinated the night beforehand. You know, you had a bomb went off in the wealthy eastern Caracas the day of the event. It looked like something out of Syria. So it was clearly, you know, an extremely tense situation. But it was a triumph. It was, you know, undoubtedly a political triumph for the Bolivarian Revolution, that, you know, right after this election, which, you know, as we recall, you know, countries throughout the world led by Trump, you know, were threatening, you know, economic sanctions, all kinds of, you know, basically total political economic excommunication against Venezuela, you know, for holding this vote, that they held it, and immediately these, you know, violent insurrectionary mobilizations led by the right wing stopped immediately and afterwards. And that was a, you know, absolutely phenomenal development. And this, you know, explains in many ways the Maduro's bump in popularity that, you know, he was able to achieve this. So I think that in terms of that, you know, in referring to your question about, you know, the constitutional legitimacy, I mean, it's clearly written in Venezuela's constitution that the president, you know, like the National Assembly, like the people can, you know, like the population can convoke this body. So there's no doubt about that. There was a particular constitutional gripe with the Attorney General with whether this can be done without a triggering referendum, but the constitution does not specify that, so it's more of a question of strict versus loose reading of the constitution. But in any case, the countries that have, you know, boycotted the, you know, this assembly, who are, you know, basically threatened the country with and have enacted sanctions against Venezuela, like the United States and Canada, you know, are in no position to offer an interpretation of Venezuela's constitution. So it's a pretty ridiculous argument from their part.
This is a very different conception of democracy from what we're used to in Canada and the United States, where democracy is basically you vote every 4 years and then, you know, do whatever in the interim. But here you have an instance where people are participating in making decisions between elections of, you know, your duly elected representatives. But you're maintaining that. I should also add that, I mean, this is coming from one of our parliamentarians. Interestingly enough, the foreign affairs critic for the left of center progressive NDP, saying that. That you're basically calling the vote for the Constituency Assembly illegitimate, and saying it's more important than ever for Canada to work with our allies and through multilateral groups like the OAS, to the Organization of American States, to secure a lasting resolution to the crisis in Venezuela. So, what are your thoughts about these sorts of statements from people in the supposedly democratic West?
Yeah, just before I get into that, I just wanted to respond to your point about this new conception of democracy, that Article 347 of the Venezuelan Constitution clearly states the original constituent power rests with the people of Venezuela. This power may be exercised by calling on a National Constituent Assembly for the purpose of transforming the state, creating a new juridical order, and drawing up a new constitution. So this is a radically, you know, different perspective of democracy, as you say. And I think in terms of Canada, the response from Canada, I mean, I think that it's not very surprising at all, given what we saw Canada's key role alongside the United States in conspiring, you know, with OAS Secretary General Luis Almagro against Venezuela earlier this year. I mean, we saw in April that these powers carried out a coup. What Venezuela and Bolivia denounced as a coup within the OAS, in which Bolivia was set to exercise the presidency, the pro tempore presidency of the permanent council, and it had effectively nullified, or it had took off the agenda a meeting to discuss Venezuela, citing that there was no reason to have a meeting without Venezuela's permission. And basically, these powers got together and they installed Honduras's representative as the president, and they convoked this session in which they sought to pass this resolution of Venezuela, which they still couldn't pass. So, I mean, Canada has been constantly pushing within the OAS for the application of the democratic charter against Venezuela, which would effectively suspend it from the body and open it up to all kinds of regional sanctions. So there's no doubt about Canada's role there.
I was wondering if you could talk about some of the opposition demonstrations that we've been seeing. What we're hearing, again, from Canadian and American politicians and others is that they're being spurred on by a humanitarian crisis that's, you know, linked to shortages of food and medicine. And so there's, you know, desperate attempts to call for Maduro to step down. What can you tell us about who the opposition is?
Well, I think it's important to recognize from the get-go that the leaders of the misnamed Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is the main right-wing opposition coalition, all of these leaders, Henrique Capriles, the current governor of Miranda, Leopoldo López, who has been convicted of leading the last round of violent insurrectionary protests in 2014, Julio Borges, the president of the National Assembly, all of these people were involved and played, you know, leading roles in the 2002 coup that ousted then President Hugo Chavez for 47 hours. In fact, Henrique Capriles and Leopoldo Lopez actually engaged in the kidnapping of the interior minister at the time. None of these people faced any jail time. None of these people, in fact, Chavez issued an amnesty for all these, which probably was an error on his part. But nonetheless, I mean, these people have zero democratic credentials. Let's also remember that this coup was blessed by the Bush administration, by the Aznar administration in Madrid, by the New York Times. So, I mean, it's very, you know, hypocritical for these people to, you know, to be speaking about democracy ever, given that, you know, in that moment, in fact, it's very hypocritical for them to be defending the current constitution, which they claim to be doing against the National Constituent Assembly, when these people, the Carmona decree, the dictatorship that came to power for those 47 hours, passed a decree that tore up the Constitution, dissolved the National Assembly, dissolved all the other existing branches of government. That, you know, clearly, you know, the most undemocratic, you know, maneuver imaginable. So I mean, this is the context we have to understand to see, you know, what's going on here. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the situation, I mean, I think that, you know, Venezuela is going through a very severe economic crisis. And, you know, there are shortages of medicines. So there is a very, you know, difficult situation there. You know, a lot of it, you know, definitely can be attributed to, you know, the mismanagement on the part of the government, particularly in the era of the oil bonanza and everything, corruption. But there's also just, you know, a reality of economic strangulation. There's always been an economic war against Venezuela, and we can go into that. But I mean, the key point is that these protests were not about that. I mean, their key demands were, you know, basically for the ouster of President Maduro, for early presidential elections, you know, despite them not being, you know, scheduled until next year. So, that, I mean, that's not really a constitutional, you know, legitimate demand in any way. And I think that we have to take this on top of the fact that, you know, the Venezuela's opposition, you know, despite all these claims of dictatorship, Venezuela's opposition actually won the December 6th, 2015 parliamentary elections, and with a majority. And yet, what did they do with that majority? Absolutely nothing. They attempted to oust the government. The new incoming head of the parliament at that time, Henry Ramos Ayu, he declared, you know, the objective of this new parliament to oust Maduro within 6 months, quote unquote. And of course, this was, you know, this is unconstitutional because a, you know, recall referendum, which Venezuela actually has, you know, provisions for, would take, you know, 8 months. So this gives you an idea of, you know, and the laws that they passed were, you know, all, you know, struck down by the Supreme Court because they were evidently unconstitutional, like an amnesty law that would have basically ripped out, you know, large numbers of pages from the criminal code and, you know, released, you know, opposition militants who are, you know, convicted or are facing charges for, you know, violent acts. As it is specified, you know, I read the law of, you know, military rebellion, you know, assault, homicide, even drug trafficking, all kinds of things like that. So it's clearly, you know, or the, you know, there's, I can go on, there's a whole number of, you know, but basically they, when they had the opportunity to legislate and govern, they made no effort to actually, in fact, they were, the parliament didn't convene 24 times due to lack of quorum because their legislators didn't show up, which evidences that they were not ever interested in governing. They were always interested in overthrowing the government as quickly as possible with the backing of the United States so they can implement their neoliberal shock therapy program. So that's always been the case.
What about the people on the ground? I'm wondering if, because I think it's very important to point out that there have been demonstrations both against the government and for the Maduro government. So I'm wondering if you could maybe compare and contrast those two different kinds of demonstrations, both in terms of numbers and in terms of tactics.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we saw on April 19th, it was a massive massive pro and anti-government demonstrations. Only the anti-government demonstrations got coverage in international media, of course. And it was massive. There was hundreds of thousands of people there. But the government side was equally massive. And, you know, with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people marching to support the government. This was similarly, the Chavista masses also came out to support the government on May Day. And, you know, there have been continual marches since then. I mean, it was a likewise, when the opposition held on July 16th what it called a plebiscite, which although Venezuela's constitution has no provision for a plebiscite, you know, this is the defenders, the supposed defenders of Venezuela's constitution, they held this plebiscite on asking their, you know, supporters if they wanted to have a National Constituent Assembly, basically asking their supporters if they wanted to have a military coup, in so many words, and if they wanted to set up a parallel government. And on the same day, the Chavista government, the National Electoral Council, held a dry run for the National Constituent Assembly elections for July 30th, which you had, you know, something like 2 million people come out for that, you know, dry run. So it's clear, and this was, of course, completely blocked out of the international media coverage, that you had this, you know, parallel show of support for the government. And likewise, you know, I think the key instance is the over 8 million people who came out to support the National Constituent Assembly on July 30th, just, you know, made crossing rivers in Tashira State, you know, in many instances. You know, you had 100-year woman being carried up the steps to vote. That, I mean, these are, you know, of course, the international media doesn't report any of these things. And, you know, in fact, attempts to, you know, delegitimize this, claiming fraud, even though the opposition has cried fraud for, you know, basically every single you know, election, except for the ones that they win, coincidentally. The key point is that, you know, this vote, this 8 million vote on July 30th was not so much an endorsement of the government as it was a rejection of the opposition violence, this terroristic violence. Likewise, it was a rejection of this economic sabotage, and, you know, it was clearly being pushed forward by the opposition. There has been mass mobilization in the streets over this past year, not necessarily totally in support of the government, but definitely, you know, in rejection of this, you know, insurrection, you know, this violent insurrectionary campaign on the part of the opposition, as well as, you know, the economic conditions that, you know, in many ways have been exacerbated, you know, intentionally by the United States and, you know, by the opposition itself.
I'm wondering what the sense is on the ground. Are we witnessing a coup in slow motion? I mean, perhaps comparable to what happened in 2002, and then there was the counter coup that overthrew that. I mean, are we looking at something along those lines, or perhaps even something more severe? What are the thoughts where you are?
I think that the key moment of danger in which, you know, there was real concern about the government being overthrown, well, you know, I think we're past that for now. I mean, that was, you know, during these, you know, this violent right-wing insurgency and these protests. But I think that, you know, the reality is that since, you know, Chavez's, you know, strategy to reform and transform the armed forces, and, you know, the fact is, you right now, you have an arm, unlike in Chile in 1973, you have an armed forces that is loyal to the existing constitutional order and is not going to engage in any coup. And without that, the opposition is incapable of overthrowing the government in the short term. And I think the opposition's willingness to quickly, to right after, you know, these National Constituent Assembly elections, to announce that it's willing to participate in the this regional elections we're going to see here on Sunday. So I think that we're, you know, the possibility of a, you know, violent overthrow of the government is not in the cards right now. I mean, I think the key question right now is the, you know, it's the, if we're not in a moment, a war of movement, as Gramsci would say, we're definitely, you know, the war position, you know, continues, in the sense the opposition is attempting to use these, you know, trying to gain a victory, a massive victory in the regional elections, which could, you know, discredit the government, which they're calling it a referendum on the government, a referendum on the National Constituent Assembly. Likewise, the government is calling, you know, likewise, you know, trying to play it up, you know, possible victory as a consolidation of its legitimacy and legitimacy of the National Constituent Assembly. So this is what is at stake, and, you know, it's really I think both sides are measuring their forces in the lead up to next year's presidential elections. So we'll see what will happen on Sunday to see, well, you know, can the United Socialist Party of Venezuela mobilize enough of its supporters, you know, in order to, you know, defend, hold the line against this right-wing, you know, international and domestic onslaught? Or is the opposition going to be able to accumulate more forces and, you know, possibly push towards a victory in presidential elections next year?
Very much appreciate your insights, Lucas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
We've been speaking with Lucas Kerner. He is a Caracas-based writer and contributor to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles also appear regularly at globalresearch.ca. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. June Julia Buxton is a professor of comparative politics at the Central European University's School of Public Policy and senior research associate at the Global Drug Policy Observatory at Swansea University. Buxton is a specialist on Latin America and an expert on Venezuela, receiving her PhD from the London School of Economics, where she also studied for her MA with distinction in comparative politics. Buxton spoke at a late September conference at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, put on by that institution's Geopolitical Economy Research Group. The focus of the talk was Venezuela, was another world possible? I had a chance to gauge her thoughts about some of the recent history of Venezuela and the dynamics currently shaping developments there.
To what extent has the rise of Chavez and his program been dependent on his personal appeal versus pre-existing dynamics within the society that's made his rise more or less a symptom? Could you address
that? No, absolutely. I think that's a very helpful observation. And what Chavez managed to canalize, to channel, was profound problems of economic exclusion, economic marginalization. Even though Venezuela is a very mixed and a very interracial society, it was also culturally a very white society. It was very much defined by its relationship with the United States. It had what was perceived as a Yankee culture, very baseball-oriented, and governed by a very traditional white political class. So you did have high levels of exclusion and high levels of political alienation. But the problem was that that couldn't really be channeled through the political system at the time. There was a lot of electoral fraud. There was a lot of repression, particularly of trade union movements that weren't affiliated to the old state system. So Chavez, indeed, I think, brought together grassroots organizations, disaffected sections within the military, a whole range of different outside popular grassroots interests and organizations, and really brought them into a ruling coalition which sought to address the inequality and exclusion that had characterized the 1980s.
Now, there have been improvements, or there were considerable improvements under Chavez in the early period, addressing the ethnic and racial disparities, the economic program and distribution. But then there were some things that were not addressed, the corruption, the social violence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why that was. Was it simply a matter of priorities, or was there blind spots? How do you account for these?
Well, Chavez inherited serious problems of corruption. He inherited a very politicized state, and he inherited a very serious problem of crime, lawlessness, and, you know, very, very serious homicide rates. And I think the problem was that in the early 2000s, certainly after 2002, when there was the failed coup attempt against Chavez, Chavez turned to really trying to build up his support, consolidate support amongst the popular sectors. And that was addressed really through the redistribution of the oil export revenues through immense programs, which did, at the time, seriously address the inequalities and exclusion of Venezuelan society. But the problem was that these issues of corruption were actually deepened. The state became more proactive in the economy through a series of expropriations and nationalizations, rather than necessarily deconstructing the old corrupt state he inherited. Chavez, in effect, built a parallel institutional framework through the misiones, the social policy initiatives. And all the time, key aspects such as violent crime continued to increase. And what we saw were efforts to address homicide and insecurity in Venezuela. But the problem was there was just such a high level of ministerial turnover. So in the Interior Ministry and the Justice Ministries, things like pretrial detention, the failures of the penal system, simply weren't addressed because nobody was in power long enough in these ministries to actually carry through a coherent program. We had something like 13 different ministers of the Interior during the 15 years of the Chavez presidency. So there kind of became a bit of an institutional inertia, which it was possible to gloss over with the oil revenues to an extent. But when the oil revenues fell, these problems came back far more serious than they'd been before.
Mm. C- Could you comment on some of the influences from external factors, particularly the United States, or the CIA, National Endowment for Democracy type interference in the society? I mean, what forms did they take, and how did their influence change from the early years, Chavez's early period, to going up to today?
Well, where we are today now with Chavez's successor after Chavez's death in 2013 with Nicolas Maduro is that Venezuela is in an acutely difficult situation. It's facing sanctions from the United States. There's a travel ban. There are also obstacles to dealing in Venezuelan sovereign debt, which the US has now imposed. And so the whole series of measures, decertification for non-compliance, alleged non-compliance in the war of drugs. And what we see really is that the Trump administration is following a pattern of continuity that we saw under President Obama, we saw under President Bush, and which actually started way back in 1997 with Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who actually refused to meet President Chavez before he was elected to the presidency. There was a view that Chavez really would be disruptive of the very strong bilateral ties that Venezuela and the US had traditionally had. Venezuela had always been a strategically important supplier of oil exports to the United States. So what we've seen is the US intervene in Venezuela in various different ways and through different mechanisms and institutions, none of which have actually succeeded in toppling the regime, and which have probably, in my assessment, served to actually prevent the anti-Chavista opposition movement from building popular support. Because the big problem is when you're receiving money from institutions such as the National Endowment for Democracy and the NDI and USAID, as the Venezuelan opposition has done, then the challenge becomes that the opposition didn't do the normal, very challenging, very tiresome hard work of going into the barrios and going into communities and rebuilding support, because instead they were looking to Washington, to the US, which were is their primary funder. So we've had efforts to support the opposition through financial resources, through military support, and also through actions in international bodies such as the United Nations, condemning Venezuela, by the US, led by the US, and US-led institutions such as Human Rights Watch and other NGOs, which have also taken a very critical stance on Venezuela from a very, very early phase, when arguably all Chavez represented was moderate social democracy. And I would argue very strongly, and I have done in my writing, that US actions actually pushed Chavez further and further to the left. So the US has created a serious situation in Venezuela, which it continues to deepen every day.
And I'm wondering about some of the influences of the Venezuela's project on other countries in South America, the kinds of impacts that they're having, for better or for worse, and whether U.S. strategy is geared at trying to create divisions between Venezuela and other countries.
It's certainly the case that the United States, through successive administrations, has sought to insulate the influence of Venezuela. During the period of the Bush administration, there was a view that Venezuela represented what they called part of an axis of evil, threatening U.S. interests in the region, but also threatening democracy and human rights in Latin America itself. Chavez benefited greatly, and his initial leverage was made possible because of a wider pink revolution, pink tide, as it was called, across the region. We had left-of-center candidates elected in Bolivia, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, Nicaragua. So Venezuela was really seen to be kind of at the leadership, at the helm of these wider leftward shifts. But the reality is that Venezuela and the election of Chavez was really very much influenced by Venezuela-specific variables. We had writers and academics at the time who tried to say that there was a good left and a bad left, and Venezuela represented a very, very bad left, so there was kind of levels of tolerance for a democratic leftism in Latin America, but not Chavez's type. And then certainly there was an effort to also isolate Venezuela and Cuba, and that changed very significantly under President Obama, who reached out to Cuba to an extent. But then what we've seen under President Trump is that those efforts to kind of divide and rule, which I think was Obama's strategy, separating Venezuela and Cuba, two very close allies, Trump has now turned that on his head, and in moving away from any form of US rapprochement with Cuba, has driven Venezuela and Cuba back closer together again.
Now, there's also, of course, the issue you mentioned earlier about the nationalization of the oil, and we've seen oil prices go down. And I'm wondering if you could point to just how significant a factor that has been to some of the difficulties that Venezuela is currently experiencing, and some of the instability that we're seeing play out currently.
Absolutely. Well, Venezuela has a history of boom-bust economic performance. This is something that goes right back to the beginnings of oil exploration and exploitation in the country in the 1920s. What's particularly salient in terms of what happened under President Chavez is Chavez came to power committed to diversifying Venezuela's reliance on oil export revenues. 96% of export revenues come from oil. But what happened during this kind of period in the early 2000s is that oil dependence actually deepened. Strategies for diversification of the economy really began to run aground. And particularly after 2006, when he was elected for a third time, Chavez emphasized that oil would become the motor of the economy. So actually, rather than diversifying, Venezuela should make better advantage from its oil resources. And it worked very closely with OPEC. It ended quota busting, worked very closely with other hawks such as Iran to try and keep the oil price high. But the problem has been, obviously, that the oil price has collapsed, and so that's left Venezuela very vulnerable. It's been devastating in terms of the economic resources. When you've moved from oil price per barrels of $120 per barrel down to around $30-$35, the implications of that for the national budget have been absolutely immense. But more problematic also is that all of Venezuela's refining capacity, essentially, is in the United States. And Venezuela never addressed those contradictions in its energy policy.
What about the unaddressed the issues of corruption and social violence that you mentioned earlier were inherited? Are we seeing that eating away at the current government? It's certainly being used in a lot of Western criticism, but I'm wondering to what extent that is those unaddressed problems have just grown and are starting to have an impact. I mean, how significant is it on top of the oil and other factors?
I'd say it's hugely, hugely salient. So you have a collapse in the oil price, so the government's capacity to maintain its redistribution programs has essentially evaporated. According to the United Nations, Venezuela has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. Now, if you want to build a participatory democracy and you want people to be out and about and engaged and deliberating, and yet it's too dangerous and violent to go out after dark, that really limits your capacity to have an engaged community. And the problem is that this violence and crime really impacts the poorest communities, because the richest communities can pay for private security and then they can protect themselves in security enforced homes. And the fact that it hasn't been addressed, deweaponization, taking so many of the guns out of Venezuelan society, it's actually been the reverse. The government has been quite willing to arm some of the groups that support it. And this is deeply, deeply problematic. And this rise in violence, I think, has really undercut the efforts to create a vibrant and active civil society, because the levels of fear and the danger are immense for Venezuela. As for the situation on corruption, this is really being exploited by Venezuela's critics. We need to see some proof for some of the more serious allegations that have been made and which have led to sanctions against individuals imposed by the United States. But it's certainly the case that there needs to be accountability for some of the immense amounts of money that came into the country during the oil boom, and which seem to have not really been accounted for through the government audit and budget procedures, which in terms themselves are also very opaque and very difficult to work through. And I do think that this has really seriously eroded, firstly, the idea that what Venezuela represents is progressive, but secondly, it's also led the Chavista movement to lose a whole swathe of social support. And what we have now in Venezuela is a society which is deeply polarized, but in which about 60-70% of the population neither support the government nor support the opposition. And that's a very dangerous situation to be in.
So what kinds of international alliances could Venezuela engage in to prop up their own aspirations for popular democracy?
Well, Venezuela has turned very much to countries such as China and to Russia, and particularly since the kind of ending of the Pink Tide and the re-election of right-wing political forces in Latin America, which has really led to the isolation, internal isolation of Venezuela within the region. It still relies on a lot of support from a number of Caribbean countries. These have been very influential in the OAS and blocking resolutions against Venezuela in the Organization of American States. Venezuela's always pursued the ideal of a multipolar world, so it's always looked to China and Russia to counterbalance the influence of the United States. But my very deep concern is that in looking in particular to China, what Venezuela has done has locked itself into a long-standing problem of commodity export dependence, except now that export market is not the United States, it's now China. And there is a very serious concern that Venezuela has effectively mortgaged its future to China because it's so indebted to China because of the huge amounts of loans that have come through from China. And in exchange, Venezuela is giving China oil reserves. And that's a very, very problematic long-term situation for Venezuela.
So that kind of leads me to my final question, which is the what-if question. You know, what could have been done differently to mitigate or prevent the economic and political situation so that they're not quite so beholden to China and some of the other issues that they're facing right now?
Okay. Well, the government maintains that they are facing a situation of economic warfare from its opponents. There is some level of credibility in that argument. But I'm afraid that my conclusion is that the government significantly have failed to adjust its economic policy. In 2002, when there was the coup attempt against Chavez, the government imposed price controls and exchange controls, and those have never been lifted. And what that has done over 15 years is to cause severe distortions in Venezuela's macro economy. We have staggering rates of inflation, and inflation hits the poorest sectors of society. It's also led to hoarding and people holding back food and supplies and not allowing those into the market, and we have an acute shortage of dollars in the country. Now, when you have a system of exchange controls, this has really become a kind of key platform for corruption. Those who are getting dollars at the official rate and then those who have to actually use the black market in order to obtain dollars. So the exchange rate system, the exchange controls have become really the key driver of the corruption. So I think the problems that Venezuela had could have been addressed through modestly adjusting economic policy, addressing these problems of inflation, lifting the exchange controls, despite the risks of capital flight that posed. There could have been adjustments made there. But most saliently, Venezuela has the cheapest subsidized oil in the world. And these oil subsidies, which essentially make oil cheaper than water, benefit the wealthiest sectors of Venezuelan society, those with the big cars. The poorest sectors usually rely on public transport. So in effect, by keeping oil, domestic petroleum, the cheapest, most subsidized fuel arguably in the world, you have created a very regressive system of income distribution. And that has not been addressed by the Venezuelan government over all of this time, I think, is indicative of the other failures.
Julia Buxton, I really appreciate your sharing these insights with our listeners.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
The Canadian government started to impose what they called the Special Economic Measures Act on September 22, 2017. Under this act, sanctions have been leveled against 40 Venezuelan officials and individuals who've, according to the Canadian government, have played a key role in undermining the security, stability, and integrity of democratic institutions in Venezuela. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, explained the move, saying, quote, "Canada will not stand by silently as the government of Venezuela robs its people of their fundamental democratic rights. Today's announcement of sanctions against the Maduro regime underscores our commitment to defending democracy and human rights around the world. Canada stands in solidarity with the people of Venezuela as they struggle to restore democracy in their country." Well, joining me right now is a professor of history at the University of Manitoba. His name is Henry Heller. He's also been very much involved in the solidarity work, and one of those actions includes an upcoming event on October 14th here in Winnipeg. So, Henry Heller, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm pleased to be here.
There's a lot of talk about human rights and democracy, but you got to remember this is the same Liberal government that approved of a $15 billion military procurement to Saudi Arabia. So I'm wondering, what do you think is behind this? Is it an authentic commitment to human rights and democracy, or is there some other motive behind the sanctions?
Well, I think that Canada is a country which has been pursuing a global strategy, which includes supporting NATO in Ukraine, and supporting directly and indirectly U.S. Occupations and invasions of Middle Eastern countries. It's involved in the occupation of Haiti alongside the United States under the mantle of the United Nations, but in fact against the will of the majority of Haitian people. And their approach to Venezuela has to be seen in this larger context. And Canada has had relations with Venezuela since the 50s. They exchanged ambassadors during the 50s. Venezuela was under dictatorship at that time, and the Canadian government didn't have any problem. Canada developed a significant economic relationship with Venezuela over the decades. The oil industry is very important. There are other sectors. There's a certain amount of Canadian investment in Venezuela.
Such as?
I think there are Canadian companies that are involved in various sectors. And from the beginning, that is to say, in 1998, when Chavez took power and brought to power a kind of populist government, the Canadian government has been resolutely opposed to Chavez because it threatens Canadian Western interests in Venezuela. The Canadian government, alongside the American government, has close ties to the upper bourgeoisie of Venezuela. And from the time that Chavez assumed the presidency, let's say in 98, until now, they have been supporting the overthrow, basically, of Chavez and then Maduro. And although, in fact, under Chavez and now under Maduro, the democratic process is actually deepening, that's exactly what they fear. So far as I know, for example, Canada has been through grants, through contacts, there is a ongoing information war going on within Venezuela, and the Canadian government has been using its expertise to support the opposition to Chavez and Maduro. So I would say that raising the question of democracy is false. It's just a falsehood. And Freeland is known as, you know, a fabricator. You know, she lacks credibility.
This does seem unusually unprecedented and hostile. Is that just a perception, or are we sort of entering a new phase in terms of Canada's engagement in Venezuela?
That's an interesting question. Well, they've been repressing the popular forces in Haiti more or less directly. I would say that you're right that the that certainly in the case of the Ukraine and Canadian involvement, military involvement, and also in Afghanistan, the counter-revolutionary nature of Canadian foreign policy is becoming more and more explicit. And certainly this act closely aligns itself with the growing aggressiveness of the United States vis-a-vis Venezuela. So they are becoming more overt, I would say. Maybe it's because they feel their grip they're losing.
Do you have any idea or thoughts about the likely impacts of these sanctions? Are they going to have an impact on economically or in any other way?
I don't think that there will be an economic impact. It's political harassment. They're directed mainly at the current political elite, the ruling political elite in Venezuela, and I don't think that the Canadian government is not in a position to do very much damage to these people. So I don't think it's going to have an effect in that way. But it might have an effect on the Canadian situation in the sense that there are signs that they're becoming more restrictive in terms of the entry of Venezuelan government officials or professors or what have you into Canada, and that may affect the ability of the Canadian public to learn what the actual situation is in Venezuela. So I would say that might be an effect.
Okay, now I understand that there is an event happening here in Winnipeg at Broadway Disciples United Church on October 14th in the evening.
Yes.
And you're helping to organize that, and you're also going to be speaking at the event. So I wonder if you wanted to just give our listeners, at least those in the Winnipeg area, a bit of a breakdown about what
It starts at 6:30, as you said, at the Broadway Disciples Church, and it's entitled Latin America... Neoliberalism in Revolt, interspersed with entertainment, Latin American entertainment from some good Latino entertainers. There will be three talks. Francisco Venezuela will be talking about neoliberalism and its effects on a particular country as an example, Chile. Peter Kolchisky of the Native Studies Department at the University of Manitoba will be talking about the effects of neoliberalism on the indigenous population, and I will be giving an overview, a sketch of the imposition of neoliberalism, which really dates from the 1970s, and its economic and political effects on the whole of the continent, and in particular stress is going to be on Venezuela. So we hope that this will be politically illuminating and also an entertaining event, and that people should come on down. And this is a free event, and I think they can meet interesting people and they'll hear some interesting perspectives.
Henry Heller, we really appreciate your thoughts. Thank you very much for sharing them with us here.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Henry Heller, a professor with the Department of History at the University of Manitoba.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks this week to University of Manitoba-based radio station CJUM 101.5 FM for the use of their recording facilities. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.